I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Eric Asimov actually wrote a beer column for his high school newspaper back in the 1970s. Later, a trip to Europe introduced him to the wonderful world of fine food and wine, and he has turned those passions into a career. He's currently the chief wine critic for the New York Times, and he's the author of a new book called How to Love Wine that he describes as part memoir and part manifesto. He writes that he wants to demystify wine drinking and the current wine culture and celebrate the simple joys of a fine glass of wine. Sounds like a good idea to me. And Eric Asimov joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. It's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Let me go back to the 1970s. How does one get to be a beer critic for a high school newspaper?
Well, you have to understand this was the 70s, a much more permissive time and a time when experimentation was valued, and it was also a sort of a time of non-authority, you know, an egalitarian time where students were considered to have as good a judgment as the faculty. And
so you tested beer, wrote about beer. Of course,
yeah,
you could drink at 18 then.
Well, yes, of course. We weren't 18, though, but my friends and I would sit up in my bedroom. We didn't even discuss this with my parents and just taste beers. And then, to give it an imprimatur of an official imprimatur, we would write a column. I would write a column.
That sounds so radical today.
And, you know, the funny thing was that nobody noticed, nobody protested. It just was, it was taken as normal. And, you know, as a parent, naturally, I would be appalled today.
But as a 17-year-old beer critic, you probably enjoyed your job.
Good training.
You also described that experience of that first sip of beer and what a bitter, almost horrifyingly shocking experience that is.
Well, this was much earlier than that. I might have been about 10 years old, but I was always curious. And we had a neighbor who, my parents barely, I never remember my father drinking a beer. He would occasionally have wine. But I had a neighbor whose father, every night, he had a bottle of Ballantine Ale. And one time the glass was left untended, and I wanted to just see what it tasted like. And it was a shock because it wasn't soda that I was used to. It wasn't sweet. And it was like, oh, my God, who drinks this?
Well, as you said, and this book is part memoir, you write a bit about growing up with your family and the fact that your parents weren't much of drinkers, but they did have a liquor cabinet. And I guess the people back
People entertained. And, of course, I think we've all gotten the idea from Mad Men that everybody is drinking all the time, for whatever reason back then. But it wasn't really true. It was a very occasional thing. I was curious, though, because there were these bottles with different colors and different levels of liquid inside and different shapes, and I always wanted to know what was in them.
Did you used to burgle your parents' liquor cabinet?
I remember opening those bottles and sniffing them, and, I do remember having that horrible cough syrup experience where you actually taste something and you spit it out because you can't understand it at all.
You also describe what a wonderful discovery going to Europe and discovering French food, French wine, and what a revelation that was to you.
Well, this again, this is in the 70s, and I was 14 years old, and I had my first girlfriend, and I was very happy about that. And my parents were going to France and insisted that I go with them, which made me very unhappy. I mean, I was a sullen child. Therefore, when we got to Paris, and my mother got sick of me very quickly and sent me out with my father, who was going to have lunch with some journalist buddies of his. And we went to a restaurant that's still there today, Bistro Allard, and just had a very simple lunch, steak, potatoes, green beans. But the flavors were just so vivid and you know, kind of cascaded in the mouth. And it just showed how denatured the ingredients we all took for granted back then in this age of instant coffee and TV dinners. And
here you were 14, missing your girlfriend, but what, falling in love with French food?
Yes. You know, I my head got turned in a different direction.
And coming back to the U.S., wanting to taste good food?
It just became a passion. And, you know, I became one of those annoying individuals who walking down a street in New York City had to stop and read every restaurant menu because I was just so curious about it. And that became the idea to reproduce that experience however I could.
So how did you go from food to wine? Not that they're not unrelated.
Well, as you can see from my high school experience, drinking was something that I was interested in, like many teenagers. But at that lunch in France, wine was on the table. And I would notice that wine was always on the table when you were having a good meal, not necessarily in my house, but outside of it. And so it just became, to me, part of that tableau, like bread or salt or something that belonged there. And as I started to cook as a student and graduate student, we started to have wine on the table every evening, and it became a habit.
Well, I would love to have you actually read a section from your book where you talk about, or you write about, just one of those wonderful eating and wine drinking experiences.
Yeah, and here I was a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, and I had been used to just buying whatever cheap wine we could afford, which were usually big, back then they called them jug wines, but they were often from the south of France or occasionally from Italy, not so much from California back then. And then one day, completely by accident, I bought a bottle of wine for $8 that was so good that, again, I just sat up and that became an experience I always wanted to reproduce.
Well, I'd love to have you read that.
We were preparing spaghetti with meat sauce, always a joyous party occasion with friends, which is why I had chosen an Italian bottle as my contribution. Other people would bring wine, too. I didn't think much about it as I opened the bottle and poured wine into glasses. It was a pretty, dark ruby red, luminous, in fact. But what was there to look at? Not until I tasted the wine did I give it a second thought, for this wine was different from any I'd ever had before. The first thing I noticed was its power, not strength in terms of alcoholic kick, but the intensity of its fruit, a bitter cherry tanginess that quite simply woke up the mouth. Yet the wine was not heavy or syrupy like some of those Italian jug wines, nor was it sweet. It was absolutely dry, a term that had taken me a while to get a handle on, but which I had finally figured out represented an absence of sugar in the wine. And the flavor lasted and lasted in the mouth, even after you swallowed. With the rich meat sauce, it was even better. I was sorry I had only brought one bottle.
And what was that bottle?
It is still one of my favorite wines today. It was a Barbera d'Alba, 1978 vintage, from Giacomo Canterno, who continues to be one of the greatest Barolo and Barbera producers in the Piemonte section of Italy.
Well, your description of that and took me back to my 20s when we would buy really, I have to say, horrible cheap wine, and I won't even name names, but each one is horrible as the other, and in part because it was cheap, but also because we didn't really know anything. I mean,
right.
We didn't know what a good wine was.
Well, you know, it's funny. The period that I'm talking about is the early 80s, and now 30, 35 years later, you have a complete revolution in the wine world where nowadays it's really hard to find bad wine or flawed wines like that used to be common. But the danger now is boring wines, which are all too common.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but also you write about the fact that technology has improved wine. I mean, the vineyards know so much more about how to grow grapes and the kinds of grapes, and then that's really added to our understanding of what wine can be.
I mean, it's kind of astounding. It's only been 100 years or so that the science of fermentation is understood. It used to be kind of a fortuitous circumstance when it worked, and now winemakers know about the importance of hygiene, cleanliness. They know how to not only shepherd the process along, but actually manipulate it. And the technology that we have now in both farming and winemaking ensures that we can have sound wine, but sometimes the interest is lost, the character.
Well, in fact, you describe driving through Salinas in California and seeing this perfectly manicured vineyard, and it was breathtaking, I guess, and it's almost perfection, but something was missing there.
Well, I mean, you went on, for one thing, the vineyard went on for miles. I mean, it was astounding, and it was interspersed with the vineyard were oil derricks. I mean,
what does that tell you,
there.
Right?
And, it's a very sort of industrial way of making wine that would have been unthinkable in the age before mechanization. And, accounts for a certain, I guess you would say, the great majority of wines that are available today.
Well, because it's consistent, right? You would probably know, it might be boring, but at least you know what you're getting from this vineyard.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I like to make the analogy between wine and food. And we don't often think of it that way, but the great mass of wine is like the great mass of food in this country. Most people who go to restaurants go to franchise restaurants or places where the food is very predictable, reliable, not surprising, but they know what they're getting.
Well, in fact, I'm scrambling here because you have a great quote from someone. A good winemakers have to give up control. The quote being, the courage to do nothing. The idea of, I guess, what, letting nature sort of work its magic when it comes to wine?
That's a famous Burgundian saying, and the specific context was that in the old days, and this is another way that winemaking has improved because meteorology has improved, and we can predict the weather far more than we used to be able to. And so growers would habitually harvest the grapes a little bit before they were ripe because it was safer that way than actually letting them ripen but risking rain. And so this guy was talking about the courage to do nothing.
To do nothing and just...
But it applies in so many different ways to wine, where it's so easy now to manipulate it with technology and science.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Eric Asimov. He's the chief wine critic for the New York Times. He's also the author of a new book called How to Love Wine, described as both a memoir and a manifesto. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions, comments, stories, give us a call. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
When Artie Goldstein pictured the person his daughter Jill would marry, a woman was not who he had in mind. But he came to not only accept it, but to want to share his story, which is how he came to star in an Expedia ad and become a YouTube sensation.
As a parent, you want to support your children.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Chick Corea and Gary Burton, November 9th in Verizon Hall. The program features music from the longtime collaborator's forthcoming album, Hot House, with new takes on standards by Weill, Monk, Jobim, and Lennon and McCartney. The duo is joined on stage by the Harlem String Quartet to explore the intersections between jazz, classical, and popular music. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Eric Asimov. For a number of years, he has written restaurant reviews for the New York Times. He's now the chief wine critic for the Times, a job he's had since 2004, writes his weekly column, The Pour, in the dining section of the paper, and he has a new book called How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Your book also takes us into the world of the wine expert, you know, whether mm-hmm. they're writing about wine or evaluating various different wines. You describe yourself, and perhaps for as a credential for yourself, that you have an enormous appetite with a swift metabolism. Is that what a wine critic needs to have?
Well, especially a restaurant critic, but yes, metabolism definitely helps. And an appetite for food and wine, for knowledge, for understanding, for communicating.
But you also say that this is a very subjective world that you live in. Yes, evaluating wines, describing wines, giving them, you know, numbers.
Yes, I mean, to a point, there, and this is always a great debate, no matter what field you're in. I mean, there is a standard of excellence that there's a lot of agreement on, but then when you depart slightly from that or explain why, that's where the subjectivity comes right. in.
Do you have to have an arsenal of adjectives to be a wine critic?
It seems that way, doesn't it?
It does.
But, you know, to me, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I kept noticing people talking to me and telling me how they felt they didn't have what it takes to understand wine. They wanted to like it, but they lacked the right equipment because all of the aromas and flavors that people keep talking about, they just didn't get. And it occurred to me that might be the problem, the way we talk about wine, think about wine, educate people about wine, that might be contributing to some of the discomfort that people were feeling about wine.
Do you think wine then is indescribable?
Oh, not at all. You can definitely describe it. I think, though, that the practice of tasting notes, describing these obscure, esoteric aromas and flavors that has really become the vocabulary for discussing wine is counterproductive. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good to know that this wine tastes like boysenberry and this wine tastes like raspberry and the third wine tastes like, a certain kind of tobacco that nobody's ever experienced. It's, to me, the farther down you go in being specific in trying to describe flavors, more testimony to ego and creativity than it is to actual communication.
You think that's kind of show-off-y? I mean, to come up with those analogies?
I don't think, I'm not sure that people think of it that way, although there's definitely a competitive urge to be more precise than the next person. But it's most definitely counterproductive because it not only doesn't communicate anything about the general character of a wine or the experience of drinking it, it ignores very important elements that go into the experience of wine, like context, food, people, mood, weather, all of
lighting.
Which have an important effect. Lighting, absolutely.
What do you think of blind tastings? I think I know what you're going to say, but say it anyway.
Well, blind tastings are useful for as a self-educational tool, but they are wrong as a means of as a sole means of judging wines because it reduces wine to sort of an object for consumer reports, like comparing toasters or cars or something like that. And really good wine, it comes from a place. It's made by people who often have been making these wines for centuries. And there's an expression of culture in really good wines that must be accounted for. And when you sort of sever wine from its origins and from any sort of context and just examine it under a fluorescent light in an operating theater, I think it does a disservice to the wine.
You do it, though, do you not? I mean, is that part of your job?
It is. And you know, I'm not completely consistent on this. It seems to be an accepted way of analyzing wines. And as I said, for me personally, it's educational and a challenge. But I have to, in writing, sometimes account for the what has occurred in a blind tasting situation and try to explain it anyway, because I don't believe that, you know, the results in a blind tasting cut through any sort of prejudice and show the truth.
How important is it to have a right shaped glass for wine, to smell it, to swirl it, to sip it? I mean, are there ways to drink wine you think that where you get the most experience, taste experience?
Well, I think good glasses are important, but we take that to absurd extremes. I mean, you know, companies design different glasses for every possible variation on a wine. You've got your Oregon Pinot Noir glass and your Santa Barbara Pinot Noir glass, and it's, you know, that's that's crazy. But a good wine glass that's generally taller than it is wide and has a kind of a tuliped top to it, those can be very helpful. And they feel good in the hand. There's something sensually pleasing about a good wine glass.
Do you miss something if you drink it out of a jelly glass?
You know something? I think that for years, that's how people have consumed wines. Mm-hmm. And some wines are perfectly appropriate to drink in those sorts of glasses. And you're not going to... You might lose part of the experience, but it's not ruined if you do that.
And that's Eric Asimov, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about wine, something that he both loves and knows a lot about. He's the chief wine critic for the New York Times, author of this new book called How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments about wine, this is the place to call. Let me see what Ron from Wynwood has to say. And Ron, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Mr. Asimov, I read your column every week.
Thank
because
you.
I find it very, very valuable. And I have a question about the consumption of the wine. Wine comes in a range of prices, and I'd like to know, is there really a qualitative equivalence to the difference in the prices between, say, a $50 wine, a $300 wine, a $3,000 wine?
Well, Ron,
and how can the producers justify such high prices?
Fair enough. Ron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, the answer is that, excuse me, possibly, but not by definition. For one thing, producers can justify whatever price they get. I mean, it is capitalism. But there's really no correlation between price and experience in the drinking of the wine. I personally believe that today you have the greatest price to quality ratio at around $20. If you are willing to spend $20, really $15 to $25, you have an enormous range of wonderful wines to choose from. If you go down to $10, you'll get decent wines, but far less excitement. And sure, you know, different kinds of wines have different price ranges, possibly scarcity or demand. Burgundy, you have to spend more. But there are so many areas that are kind of new to our wine drinking in this country that are reasonably priced. where you can have wonderful experiences for far less money.
Ron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What's the most expensive bottle of wine you've ever drunk?
Priceless. I had a bottle of, well, the oldest wine I ever had, an 1846 Merceau.
Oh, wow.
Consumed in Burgundy at Bouchard Père et Fils, the producer. So, you know, that's not a wine that you can go buy anywhere. And, you know, part of my challenge and my joy is to communicate the experience of a wine like that for vicarious pleasure rather than like, you know, lucky me, I got to drink it and you didn't.
What did it taste like?
Well, for one thing, it was surprisingly fresh and, you know, alive for a wine that was 160 years old at the time. And, you know, I said it could have been 100 years younger.
You also write about that, and perhaps this is where we're headed here, but there seems to be a fair amount of, and I'm using your words here, fears and inhibition about wine. And perhaps it's because there's so much to choose from, and oftentimes you feel like you have to be an expert or you have to know what it is that you're buying or you're ordering. Should we be fearful and inhibited about our wine drinking?
Well, absolutely not, although I completely understand the feeling. First of all, you know, it's an arcane subject. There's a lot to learn and a lot to memorize. And I think we've been communicated a false message by books that one volume that purports to teach us everything we need to know to never order the wrong bottle again, how not to embarrass yourself in front of your boss, you know, that sort of thing. No, it's like, if you want to learn how to play golf, you don't watch one video and read one book. You've got to do it for years and years.
So try it, taste things,
yeah.
See what they taste like.
But I think, you know, more than that, we've got a culture that describes things in these sort of esoteric tasting notes that don't square with our own experience. And a lot of people think, oh, there must be something wrong with me. Then.
Because I don't taste the raspberry or
right,
something like
exactly.
that.
Right, exactly. And then there's the, you know, always the stereotype of the haughty sommelier who's going not only going to sneer at you but rip you off, and so you almost go into a restaurant and crouched in a defensive position, and
not a good way to enjoy a meal.
No.
So do you suggest people, I mean, as you say, find a good wine store? Now, we are in Pennsylvania, and
yes.
We do have a state store system. Not that some of them aren't good, but nonetheless, that's a whole other world. But you say, find a wine store or liquor store where you feel like people know what they're talking about and try things. I mean, buy a bottle, try it at home,
It's it's the best way and the easiest and most pleasurable way if you can find a good wine shop and meet somebody there and establish a relationship, a business relationship. And, you know, people who work in wine shops, good shops, are passionate about what they're doing, and they like nothing better than to turn you on to what they love. And establish a relationship like that, they become invested. Mm. And so I suggest, trying different wines. And you have to do a little work also if you want to learn. You have to keep notes and try to understand what it is you like and what it is you don't like. And then if this is something that captures you, and that's the time to start taking classes and reading books and things.
Let me see what Bob from Atlantic City has to say. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Sorry to interrupt there. I'm
no
having
problem.
A little bit of a hard time hearing you. I've been a waiter for 36 years, and my wife is a sommelier. And the evolution of wine in America is amazing. When I first started, a wine list was one page that consisted of Lancers, Matus, Blue Nun, and now Americans have become very wine savvy. And it's a joy to serve. And experiences I have had standing with Philip Tony in his garage tasting wines the day after Robert Parker has been there. My wife has gotten me involved in actually making trips like that. And the world of wine is just wonderful. And that's all I really wanted to
well,
say.
Well, I'm glad you did, Bob.
What a treat it is to listen this morning.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, for calling into Radio Times, underscoring really what you write about in this book and what we've been talking about, which is just we're living in a revolution of wines.
It's just a tremendous time to be a wine lover. We have a greater diversity of wines, diversity of styles. They come from all over the world nowadays. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the books, because there's so much pleasure to be had if people can open themselves and feel a little more at ease with wine.
And would you say that American wines are as good as some of the wines you might drink in France or Germany or Spain or... Are they different? I mean, is there something different about American
wine? Well, there's definitely something different. I would say there are great American wines, for sure. I think we have a much younger wine culture, so it's harder to find those sorts of wines of cultural expression that I was talking mm-hmm. about before. We just don't have that history. But they are out there, and I think right now... You've got kind of a younger generation coming of age in California, in New York, Oregon, Washington, and so many other states, including Pennsylvania, that are seeing wine in a little bit different way than their who they learned from. And I feel very optimistic about American wines right now.
Well, and I've said this before on the air, my pet peeve are those oaky, buttery Chardonnays. I mean, there are many other kinds of Chardonnays, but I know that was kind of a rage for a while.
Well, you know, that was the style. That was the style of the 90s, and it got all sorts of critical acclaim. But this has been the kind of leading edge in the American wine revolution, where there was such a kind of a counter attack to those sorts of wines that people have been pulling back and making wines of much more restraint and elegance and subtlety. And I see now you start to see it in other areas, Cabernet and Pinot Noir, Syrah.
And does France still sort of hold this special place when it comes to wine? Just because of this long tradition, you've got vineyards that go back generations. There's just this knowledge about and tradition, culture of wine.
I don't think there's any way to deny that. France is the seat of great global winemaking, and if you look around the world. Look in California, the wines that they're emulating there are all French wines. Now people are going their own way and carving out their own identities. But even more than that, France has such a tremendous diversity of wines. We can't hope to match that right now. And they have the tradition, which you see in other old world countries, but their sort of their global identity is a little bit less established than France's.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation of pretty much a full bank of calls here. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about wine with Eric Asimov. He's the chief wine critic for the New York Times, author of a new book called How to Love Wine, a memoir and manifesto. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture, hosting an open house at their Chester County campus October 27th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Wolfe. His new novel, Back to Blood, is set in Miami. Also, part two of my recent interview with Stephen Colbert. Since he loves music and loves to sing, for this part, we asked him to bring a few tracks of music that mean a lot to him and tell us why. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll get the view of the American election from the Arab world. What were the tweets, the headlines, and why is the coverage of this election different from others? Also, Tony Wheeler, the ultimate globetrotter, the founder of the Lonely Planet Travel Guides. He'll make a stopover with us. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, Eric Asimov is our guest. He loves to eat and drink. He has turned those passions into a career. Back in 1992, he started a popular restaurant column in the New York Times called $25 and Under. He also reviewed takeout food in his to-go column. He's now the chief wine critic for the New York Times and writes the weekly column The Pour in the dining section of the paper, and again, author of his first and new book called How to Love Wine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Tom from Upper Black Eddy to join our conversation. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're
it's
welcome.
A great program.
Thank you.
Some of the best wines from America that I've ever tasted are California Cabernets that had been made in the 70s and early 80s. They were big, they were fruity, they were all the adjectives that everybody talks about. But in my little parlance, I always imagine this huge fist coming out of the wine glass and grabbing me by the face and shaking me. And that's the kind of wine I really, really love. And they just stopped making them. And I'm so disappointed. I have not been able to find that quality Cabernet that is just so big and massive coming out of California lately. And I'm curious to know if you have any observations about that.
Well, Tom, I love your description of this hand coming out of your glass and grabbing your face. Let me see what Eric Asimov says.
Well, that, I love that description, too. But I'm curious about the words you choose, big and massive, because probably the one of the major distinctions between Cabernets of that time and now is that those Cabernets were leaner and, for one thing, far less alcoholic, maybe 12.5 or 13% as against 14.5 to 15.5 now, and that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And also the many now are far more powerfully fruity. But those, you're right, I agree with you. Those are some of the greatest American wines ever, and I think they're. Was a stylistic shift since then, and it's also important to remember that if you're still drinking those wines now, it's because those were the best wines of the times, and they had the ability to age and evolve.
Where does one go though to get that big taste, that big experience that Thomas is describing?
Well, I believe that there are Napa Cabernets now that are either still made in something similar to that style or are slowly kind of reverting back to it. For example, the Cabernets of Kathy Corison are superb and age beautifully, and that's very much of that style.
Tom, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Andy from Sicklersville has to say. And Andy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about wine clubs. A lot of companies, including Eric's boss, the New York Times, have these wine clubs where you send in X number of dollars every month and they send you 4 or 5 bottles of wine. I'm wondering, is that the cheap stuff or can you get good bargains on those wine clubs?
Well, go ahead, Eric.
Well, I'll just say that... let me say first that I have nothing to do with the New York Times Wine Club. It's a completely separate entity. And in fact, you know, a lot of these wine clubs, the Wall Street Journal has one, a lot of different magazines and have them. They're sort of one or two companies that run these things, and then they just put the brand name on top. So it's, you know, it's a good commercial enterprise for everybody concerned and for people who may not have access or want to spend the time deciding what to buy. It can be a good deal.
Well, picking up on what you said earlier about educating yourself about how
wine is.
I mean, you don't have that personal experience with a guy that works or the woman that works at the
and
store.
You're far less likely to get quirky or eccentric wines than you are sort of mainstream wines, but there's nothing wrong with them. Not at all.
Andy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. As you describe in your book, you're really a self-taught wine critic. You took a class, but you weren't particularly impressed. Would you say you're self-taught?
I absolutely. You know, there's an old saw in the wine business. The way to learn about wine is to pull corks, plenty of them. And that was basically my approach. I was going to drink a lot of wine, and after a while, I started trying to pay attention to what I was drinking. And, you know, you have to have a lot of conversations with people and to try out things, explore different theories, pull back when necessary. But, I found that wine classes, they don't teach you how to love wine, for example. They teach you how to taste wine.
And that's different.
And I believe that's very different. And one of the theses of my book is that our culture conveys that in order to enjoy wine, you have to know everything about it first. You have to, in a sense, essentially become a connoisseur before you can simply enjoy wine. And my feeling is that that equation is backwards. The first thing you want to do is establish an emotional connection to wine. Fall in love with it. And then you're motivated to want to learn more about it, to be curious about it, not because you want it, not because it's a sense of obligation.
Let me see what Anne from Ardmore has to say. And Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks. I've got three empty bottles sitting in front of me. I wanted to start by saying that the best way to enjoy wine is with good food and good friends.
Absolutely.
Which is, a few months ago I had my 70th birthday, and one of my brothers stunned me with a box of California wines, which I'd never tasted. In fact, one of the names, there's a Windsor Sangiovese. I never heard of Sangiovese. It's from the Sonoma Valley. Pinot Grigio, I've drunk all my life. There's another one, Cosentino California Red Wine. It's called Old Red. Well, I had all these good wines, and I wanted to do something, but I live alone, and I'm not a drunkard. So I invited a bunch of friends for dinner. I took the list of what I wanted to serve to the liquor store in Ardmore, and the manager there was fantastic. He told me, put that one away for another time. This doesn't go with your menu. Here's what you serve with your fish pate, and here's what you serve with cheese. Here's what you serve with chicken marbella. And it was all so good that partway through the meal, one of the guests said, do you have some note cards around here somewhere? I said, sure. I want to write a letter to your brother and say thank you for this wine.
And that's a great story. And I think, I mean, it underscores, I would say, the thesis of your book, Eric.
Absolutely. I think, you know, wine, food, people, they all go together. And there's a synchronicity where they each enhances the other. And when you try to put, anything, any part of that into a vacuum, you lose a lot. And, I think a lot of times our wine magazines and so on put such a premium on great wines and wines in isolation, what wine will do for you, for your health or whatever. It's really about how it all fits together. And I like to think of wine as kind of a complementary player, an ensemble player, not the diva that's going to overshadow everything, but that's going to play the crucial but maybe a little quiet role that enhances everything. And if your focus as a magazine is wine, you want to play up the importance of the wine, and I think sometimes that's counterproductive.
It's an ensemble. right?
Yes,
an ensemble
exactly.
cast. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Interestingly, she said, "I'm not a drunkard." Is she? Do you have to worry about drinking too much, or?
I think anybody does.
Yeah,
you know?
But as someone who's a wine critic, and I'm assuming drinks a fair amount of wine.
Yes, I think you know. In addition to the little litany I gave before of an enormous appetite and a fast metabolism, I should also say a non-addictive personality, which I think is very mm-hmm. important.
Do you drink every day? I mean, do you have
a
glass of wine? Like with dinner or lunch?
I have wine with dinner every day, occasionally with lunch, but that depends on what I have to do after lunch.
Siesta or not, right?
Yeah.
Right. Let me see what looks like Jim from Newtown has to say. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. Great show.
Oh, thanks, Jim. Go ahead.
My question is about cork versus cap. I had heard there's a shortage of natural cork and that many wineries would switch to caps, but it has a reputation for, like, cheap wine. Could you talk, does it affect the taste of the wine, whether it's a cork or a cap?
That's a good question, Jim. Yeah,
yes,
go ahead, Eric.
It's not so much a shortage of cork as that as wine became more popular, the quality of cork went down because they needed to use so much of it. And so you would find a lot of wines that were tainted by a cork component, a mold that existed in the cork. And so as a solution, a lot of wineries went to a screw cap.
Right.
And I think, you know, we've come a tremendous way since the days when those were associated only with bad cheap wines. And certain cultures have now embraced the screw cap. Australia and New Zealand, if you travel there, you'll see 95% of all wines have the screw cap on it. But there are always unexpected consequences, and they have found that while screw caps solve the problem of cork taint, they create their own problems, and that has to do with wine chemistry and the sort of impermeable environment that the screw caps create, and they have to adjust their winemaking a little bit and their approach. I personally think they're perfectly appropriate for fresh wines that you're going to drink young. I'm not convinced that they're the way to go for wines that you want to age.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You have a chapter in here titled The Importance of Being Humble.
Yes.
And I was surprised to read this chapter.
Well, you know, I think that because wine making is a natural process, an agricultural process, you have to remember, if you are a grape grower or a winemaker, that you can't control it completely. I think that we have tried to do that, and as a result, we can make great very good mass produced wine, but this is the sort of wine that maybe is not that interesting. Mm. It's kind of like the miracle of modern agriculture, where you can now grow enough food to feed everybody in this country, but perhaps the quality of the food has diminished.
Do you also think, though, that humility, modesty is important for a wine critic, or
yes.
any of us who enjoy a glass of wine?
Because we also have to remember that that wine is a mystery in a lot of ways. And you often hear the term demystifying wine. I don't believe in that at all. I believe in demystifying wine drinking. But wine itself, the mystery is part of the beauty of it. And I think that our wine culture is intended to eliminate the mystery, to boil it down to a set of aromas and flavors, to tell you how good it is on the 100-point scale, to tell you when to drink it and with what to drink it. And they want to ensure that they eliminate as far as they can any sort of chance that's involved. Mm-hmm. And for me, winemaking is all about surprise and beauty, or wine itself is all about surprise and beauty and mystery. And a wine importer, Terry Thies, coined the phrase remystifying wine. And I believe in that.
We started with your career as a beer critic for your high school newspaper. You also tasted the beer that's been grown at the White House.
Well,
Made at the White House, I should say.
Yes, and we created a facsimile of that. I still write about beer occasionally. I love beer, and we tried very hard to get an actual bottle of the White House beer, but they were not giving out any. So we got a local brewer, Brooklyn Brewery, to make a small batch according to the recipe used by the White House, and it was really good.
Really good meaning really good?
Really good, yes. I mean, of course, there's something wonderful about homemade beer, as all home brewers know. Yeah, you can make mistakes, but there's a freshness to it, and it's alive in a way that, you know, the more store-bought beers generally are not. They have other things going for them, but this vivid feeling was right there.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Eric Asimov. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
And he's the wine critic for the New York Times, author of this new book called How to Love Wine, and it's subtitled A Memoir and Manifesto. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. And we want to close things out with Anita O'Day singing Dave Frischberg's Peel Me a Grape.
Peel me a grape. Crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow, start me a smoke, talk to me nice, you've got to warn me, I'm dying, don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me, I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just to entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid glove me, this way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry, feel me a grape. Is how to be an agreeable chap. Love me, believe me, give me.